Thanks, Nathan. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. And while you are thinking through how to follow up on what Andy and Nathan have been telling you, we have an interesting set of ethical questions for you to consider here. During the flu pandemic of 1918-1919, tens of millions of people died worldwide. A new study asked the citizens of Maryland to consider the ethical choices that would have to be made if such a flu were to strike again. Who would be treated first? How would ventilators be allocated? They asked people from around the state to consider those questions. The results were published in the Annals of the American Thoracic Society. And joining me now to speak about this is the principal investigator of the study, Dr. Elizabeth Lee Dougherty Bittison. She's the vice chair for clinical operations at Johns Hopkins Medicine and an expert in critical care. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also involved in the study was Dr. Eric Toner, an emergency physician and senior associate at the UPMC Center for Health Security, which is managed by the University of Pittsburgh, but is actually based in Baltimore. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Sheila.
And also with us is a doctor who helped shape the federal government's response to the H1N1 outbreak in 2009, the swine flu outbreak, Dr. Lewis Rubinson. He was a commander in the Public Health Service and is now director of the Critical Care Resuscitation Unit at the Shock Trauma Center at the University of Maryland.
Good morning, Sheila.
Good morning. Now, Dr. Bittison, tell us how you formed these groups of citizens.
So we used a variety of methods for the groups that are in this first study. We used existing partnerships, both in Howard County and in East Baltimore, to gather interested citizens to have these conversations.
So you just basically ask a group of citizens to come and consider?
We did, yes.
And what scenario did you present to them?
So the scenario we presented was the scenario that you just described in 1918, where in which a pandemic is occurring all across the country.
Thousands. And a pandemic differs from an epidemic how?
Because it's widespread, so it would involve the entire nation or the entire world. So not localized in one place like you would see potentially with an epidemic, but actually widespread.
Okay. And so I'm sorry, I interrupted you. You were saying what you presented to them.
So we presented them a scenario like the 1918 pandemic, widespread illness, numbers of people ill, critically ill, requiring hospitalization, orders of magnitude greater than those assets that were available, than the beds that were available, than the doctors that were available, than the hospitals or ventilators that were available. And we said to them, consider these numbers. This is a huge, even in a scenario in which we're doing everything that we can, all hands are on deck, everybody, all the healthcare providers, all the resources are in play, we still don't have enough to take care of the folks who need them. How are we going to decide who gets care first, who is prioritized to receive those resources?
Dr. Toner, what conclusions did people come to?
Well, people tended to there was not a consensus, but general agreement around that the approaches that should be used were those that save the most number of lives. But there were a number of people who also felt that fairness or social justice issues or processes that gave everyone equal access were also very important issues.
Okay. I mean, I hear you say fairness, and my reaction is, well, duh, of course. I mean, how did the people you talked to see fairness? What did they define as fairness?
Well, we asked them to consider six different ethical approaches. One was a lottery system. One was first come, first serve. And those generally would be considered fair, at least in some ways of thinking about them. We also asked them to consider issues like prioritize those people most likely to survive, prioritize those people that are youngest, prioritize those people who have some value to society in the pandemic, such as healthcare providers. And we asked them to try and weight these different approaches and see which ones resonated with them the most. So the ones that were many people considered fair were lottery and first come, first serve.
Not so much looking at what you do in life, what you contribute to society, or even how likely you are to survive because of the treatment.
Right.
Hmm. And did it differ depending on where people were? I mean, the first two groups that you looked at, did you come up with the same consensus, or was there a different sense in the suburbs than in the inner city?
Well, in terms of the approach that most people resonated with, you know, or chose, it was pretty much the same. But there were key differences as well. People in the inner city were really interested in, really concerned about social justice issues.
Mm-hmm.
and whether they would be have access to care. Mm-hmm. People in the suburbs were really interested in issues about process. How would this actually work? Logistical questions, operational questions. So there were distinct differences.
Dr. Rubison, you worked with the federal government to shape emergency response to the H1N1 outbreak in 2009. Did the government make plans then about allocating resources?
Sure. Just first, Sheila, I want to mention that now no longer being in uniform, I don't speak for the government.
Sure.
But I can summarize, there was an extensive amount of activity that was started long before the 2009 H1N1 pandemic. A lot of the activity really started to pick up when other strains of flu were starting to spread across Asia, and there was concern that a pandemic was going to eventually impact the U.S. The way the pandemic played out was surprising for us, but a lot of the plans already were in place. I think when you categorize the plans, most of the activities on prevention, it's much easier to be able to manage folks in the population before they get sick.
Sure.
And that strategy is mostly around vaccine. Uh-huh. Unfortunately, vaccine production in the country is quite limited. So HHS has taken a huge initiative on being able to create advanced development so that we have the vaccine capability to come out much sooner. In a pandemic, that played out a little bit during 2009 and in the future will play out even more. In addition, early treatment and making antivirals available was also a big part of the plan. And then HHS has invested significantly on providing additional equipment and being able to organize the healthcare system to be able to extend the resources so that hopefully you never get to the situation that Dr. Darty and Dr. Toner described in the first place.
Right. I get that getting ahead of the problem, coming up with either preventive steps or with more hospital beds, more ventilators would be ideal. But did the federal government also look at what happens if we've maxed both of those out and we still need to triage?
It's a great question, and absolutely, you can imagine that any scenario can exceed resources, and there's only so much you can invest for a what if scenario. So the government has participated through the Institute of Medicine and through other activities, supporting some through grant monies to groups such as the Center for Biosecurity of UMC, Hopkins, Seattle, and other groups that have addressed some of these ethical issues, in addition to also creating plans and implementation strategies. I would say if it had to have been done, it would have been very messy, but there was a lot of initiation of that activity, and I think it continues to build on itself, but it was not entirely completed and I think ready for prime time, which you'll probably hear from these guys is probably true throughout the country.
So let me make sure I understand what you're saying, that the government was trying to, as it was doing all this other stuff, was also talking about what do we do if we have to triage resources. They really hadn't gotten very far along in doing that, the federal government.
They had gotten somewhere, but remember, most healthcare delivery is done in the private sector. Right. So you can create the conceptual constructs, but in terms of being able to organize the millions of folks who are in the healthcare system and then all those in need, I think there was a lot more planning than probably the ability to implement at the time. And again, that's something that takes probably a generation to truly go from idea to being able to actually operationalize.
On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. You were just hearing Dr. Louis Rubinson, who's with the Shock Trauma Center at the University of Maryland, and had worked on the swine flu epidemic in 2009 for the federal government. Also with us are two of the authors of a study about the ethics of allocating care, Dr. Elizabeth Lee Dougherty Bittison with Johns Hopkins, and Dr. Eric Toner, a senior associate at the UPMC Center for Health Security. Dr. Rubinson's comment makes me understand I should have probably asked one of you to start. Why did you undertake this study? What What was it that made you think this is the question we need to answer?
So that's an excellent question. And I think some of the things that Lewis just raised are really important points about why we did the study. And that is, there are a lot of questions out there about at what level of government or what level of organization these types of decisions should be made. So one can imagine, taking one quick step back, we went into this project with the assumption that there are a number of different ethically appropriate, morally appropriate ways you could make these decisions. And those are along an entire range of things that Dr. Toner mentioned a little bit earlier. Everything from a lottery to a ethic that says we should save the most lives. There are different ethical arguments that support those approaches, but there are ethical arguments for that. And the different arguments may resonate differently with different groups of people and with different values. You might see in one community that has a very strong bond or tie to the seniors, the elderly in their community, they would not want to necessarily over-represent or over-prioritize the young or judge based on age, valuing that input of the elderly, for example. Others may see that differently and want to choose something differently. So knowing that there is both this range of ways that problem could be approached and that the values in a given community should necessarily be reflected in this important decision-making process in a time of crisis, we wanted to engage those communities and ask them, which of these is most important to you? Which resonates most strongly with you? Because inevitably, as you jump into a crisis mode where everyone's stress, tension level is high, if people don't understand what's going on and don't have a voice, you're going to end up with a much more chaotic, stressful, and potentially exacerbate the disaster.
The idea of rationing care is enormously controversial in this country, and I don't know whether you even use that word. Dr. Toner is shaking his head. But essentially, you're getting very close to asking the public how to do that. Are there other parts of the world where this is an easier set of conversations to have, where the idea is more comfortable for more people?
Well, I think in other countries, making decisions around allocation of limited resources is a daily event. There are many countries, probably most countries, in which there are not enough medical resources for everybody who needs them. It's not the case in the U.S., but it is the case in many countries. But I don't know that they necessarily have a well-thought-out ethical framework for how they make those decisions. I think typically those decisions are made by a doctor or a nurse at the bedside and using their own set of values and moral judgments. And, you know, I think it would be better to have a well-vetted, well-thought-out, generally agreed-upon framework, which is what we're trying to work towards.
Dr. Rubinson made the point that most healthcare in the United States is delivered in the private sector.
Yes.
So what do you envision doing with your research? And I should say, by the way, I don't think we've mentioned, you started with these two groups that you looked at and did an initial study, and now you've convened 10 other groups all around Maryland, and you're examining what they told you. So there'll be more that you'll know. What will you do with those results?
So the plan is to gather a group of experts to synthesize all of that data and develop a final report that synthesizes, clarifies what the feedback is from across the state, incorporating feedback from Western Maryland, Frederick, down to the Eastern Shore, and use that or offer that to the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene to consider as part of the potential development of a statewide plan or statewide framework to make these type of decisions.
Dr. Rubinson, you're not part of this study, but you've worked in the federal government. Now you're working at Shock Trauma, and you're teaching medicine. So you might be in some way a consumer of the results of their study. How does it strike you? I mean, is it something that you as a doctor would welcome, or is it sound like abstract out there? Not my problem.
Well, in terms of true disclosure, I've collaborated with both of these folks quite extensively, although not on this particular project. But I think putting my hat on as someone who needs to advocate for my patients and also make sure that the system that I work in is able to continue functioning, I think you have to take a critical eye at what they're doing. But they've given us more insight into what people on the street would tell us to do rather than, you know, the first work that we did on this was years ago, which was putting a bunch of folks who were ethicists and clinicians and experts on this. And we had our own ideas on it, but we didn't know if that really truly made sense. I think they've taken us the next step to actually go out and really do good, appropriate, rigorous work to try and get more guidance on what should be the guiding principles that we have to work on. And I think most folks will look at that with open arms, that this is more information when you're trying to build this than just do it from closed doors in an academic center.
We're basically out of time, but just tell me briefly, when can we expect more results from your from this last set of 10 conversations you've had around the state? What kind of timeline are we looking at?
We're hoping to have that data synthesized over the course of the next year.
Will you come back and tell us about it?
Happily.
We'd be happy to.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Dr. Elizabeth Lee Dougherty-Bittison is Chair for Clinical Operations at Johns Hopkins Medicine and an expert in critical care. Dr. Eric Toner is an emergency physician and senior associate at the UPMC Center for Health Security. And Dr. Louis Rubinson is director of the Critical Care Resuscitation Unit at the Shock Trauma Center at the University of Maryland. We have a link to the study and the ethics of allocating resources at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning.